Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Indie Review Behind the Scenes. This is the weekend edition, and I am Michelle Conwell-Jordan. I am your host, and this evening I have joining me author Kay Holland Van Zandt. She's here as part of her Premier Virtual Author Book Tour. Hello. Hello. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Do you have
Hello?
Me?
Hi. Hi.
Hi.
How are you? Hi.
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah.
You're welcome. I'm so sorry. I know it's almost like a mad dash at the very end, so I do apologize for that. But
no,
I'm glad that
no
we're
problem.
Here and that you're able
here,
to join
we're
us.
We're here. We made it.
We're here. We made it. I feel like we can just, we're done. I mean, we made it. We made it across the line here.
Showing up.
I don't know if you
Woody,
ever felt
Woody
like
Allen.
That when you
Woody Allen
you put
said,
so much
80, showing up is 80% of success, so we're mostly there.
There we did it. All right, so what we're gonna do, Kaya, correct?
Kaya.
I want to make sure.
Kaya.
See, I had it right the first time. Everyone listening, I'm gonna go ahead, and we have just one brief message, and then we'll come back and jump into it. Also, to all of my listening audience, you may can tell my co-host Jamie White is not joining us tonight, but she will be back next weekend, next Friday. She does have a writing event this week, so we miss you, Jamie. But Kaya and I, we're gonna have loads of fun. All right, we'll be back after this brief message, guys.
Hi, this is Cecile Monique, and you're listening to Indie Review Behind the Scenes, your source for the hottest in indietainment's news and features.
All right, and if you're just joining me again, thank you so much for joining Indie Review Behind the Scenes. I'm Michelle Conwell-Jordan, and I'm speaking with Kay Holland Van Zandt. Kaya, welcome to the show again, and could you please tell a little bit about yourself for our listening audience?
Sure. Personal? How personal do you want to get?
Oh, my goodness. We want to know all. No, I'm just joking. Just about yourself, what you do, things like that, you know.
All right. So I live here in California, and I'm a writer. I've been a writer all my life, and I'm a single mom right now. I'm 40. And I spent 10 years writing and researching my first novel, which was just released.
That is incredible. Well, congratulations on your book, baby. Yes, it is always a special, special moment. I also have your information in front of me. I mean, you've done some awesome things. You know, you've toured with the Magic Show, and swam with dolphins, and you've lived an adventurous life. I mean, you could write a book just about that, so that's awesome, too.
That's my next book.
That's your next book. There you go.
It is.
Well, Kaya, let's just jump right into it as far as your writing. I always like to ask, how did you get on this writing path? Was it a newfound passion or a lifelong dream for you?
Wow, you know, for me, it's taken me maybe decades to realize this, but I think it's always been true. Writing is like my third lung. It's part of my health and my pulse and what I need in order to feel my most alive and happy. And I didn't really know that about myself until a boyfriend in my 20s was like, you know, you really need to write every day. You're a much more enjoyable human being when you do that. And then I was like, oh, really? I am? Oh, I didn't know. So in my mid-20s, I started working on my first novel, but I had always been writing. I mean, my first book I wrote when I was 7, and it was probably, I don't know, maybe 5 pages long and dirs, and it was called The Dumb Witch, and it was a bit of a whodunit kind of, you know, surprise ending. They all had a party afterwards, which I think is the way to end every book now. I should end every book
every
with a big
book.
Party. That was my
yes.
best idea.
Every book in that way. I love that. Tell us about Written in the Ashes, where the story idea came from, and, you know, what a reader would expect.
Yes. Well, my writing mentor is novelist Tom Robbins, who wrote Skinny Legs and All, and even Cowgirls Get the Blues. I've known Tom since I was 18. He's been my pen pal, and I decided I wanted to write a book, but I didn't know what about. So I wrote him, and I said, Tom, what do? I think I'm ready to write a novel. I was about 25, and he said, don't worry, it will find you. You should quit writing until it does. So I kind of put it out there to the universe, like, okay, universe, I quit writing until you send me the idea that I want to get married to. Maybe this works with dating, too. I haven't tried it yet, but if you just, you know, put that out there, like, okay, I'm ready for the one, right? That was the feeling. So I did. I quit writing, even journaling for me, which was new, or writing in my diary for about a year. And then I was dating an Egyptologist, and we started talking about the Great Library of Alexandria, and I was just so interested in it, and I said, oh, gosh, that's an interesting, you know, crazy story. Is it true that it burned, and how did it burn, and when did it burn? And he was working on his thesis at the University of Berkeley, which has an incredible Egyptology department, and he said, well, no one knows. No one knows how it burned or when. And I was like, what? Come on. Like, you know, we know when what Caesar was having for breakfast on the morning of his battles. How do we not know when the greatest library in antiquity burned to the ground? And he said, we just don't. And I thought, that sounds fishy. So I started, like, doing my own little bit of research, you know, going to the university libraries, poking around. It became a bit of a treasure hunt, almost a Da Vinci Code kind of treasure hunt. Like, oh, my God, I found a scrap. I found a piece. I found something that could be leading to the answer. And then ultimately what really happened was something totally synchronistic and spiritual and, you know, maybe fate, if you believe in that kind of thing, or past lives. I'm not even sure. But I wrote a short story about one of my main characters in the book, Alizar, who's a Gnostic alchemist who had the foresight to realize the library would burn. So he was preserving the manuscripts and hiding them around the Mediterranean so they wouldn't be found and destroyed. And I liked him. I knew him right away in the writing of this story. He was like an old friend coming back. And I just said, oh, I've got to spend time with him. So in writing the book, or what started off as the short story, I went to spend time with him, and then I started writing about this girl named Hannah, who is a shepherdess, a Jewish shepherdess living in Mount Sinai, and a terrible nightmare she was having about a woman being attacked, raped, murdered, and the entire world around her on fire with what in the dream she described as birds on fire flying through the air, which, of course, were the scrolls. And as I wrote this story, I went, oh, I'm nuts. You know, it's just so violent, and a woman wouldn't even be running the Great Library, and all this, you know, it's so brutal. Why did I write this? And I shoved it in a drawer. Another year went by, and then I started doing research on, you know, when the library could have burned, and I discovered Hypatia of Alexandria, whom I'd never heard of and who coincidentally or synchronistically died exactly verbatim as how I had written in the short story. And I walked around my house for an hour going, oh my God, I have a window. I have some kind of window to what happened back then. And right then and there, I married it. I committed. I said, whatever this takes, this will be more than a short story. This will be my first book, and I'll just do whatever it takes to write it. And it took about 3 times longer than I thought it would take, 10 years in total to get it written and published. But I'm quite proud of the result.
That is incredible. It sounds fascinating. So let me make sure I understand. You researched or wrote about a character, but when you research the actual person that you weren't aware of actually died the exact same way that you wrote about. Is that correct? Or something
like that? That's
right. Did I?
I just thought when I wrote the story, I thought it would be really cool to make a woman run the great Library of Alexandria. But then I thought, well, I'm nuts. There's no way. Are you kidding? In the age of men, women weren't even literate in this age. There's no way a woman would be running the great library, much less murdered in this way that I wrote about. So as I started discovering about Hypatia, or she's sometimes known as Hypatia, I was, you know, just shocked to find out, yes, there was a woman running the great library of Alexandria in the 5th century. It's around the last time we know of anything of the great library of Alexandria, and she was brutally murdered by a Christian mob. Sadly, in the city square that's called the Agora.
That really is. I have goosebumps here. That is incredible. really, I think that's incredible.
Thank you.
I love research. I love history. So to see that, you know, correlation there is incredible. 10 years, that is an investment. And so the process, how did you write? Was it in pieces? Did you have a dedicated time every day? How did you make this work?
I had a job. I had a job, and I was also teaching yoga full time. So what I had was a three hour window in the middle of the day between classes. I usually taught 3 classes a day. So sometime between like noon and 3 or 4 in the afternoon, I would grab lunch and work on the book pretty much, you know, four to five days a week. And early on, it was like I would have to drag myself there because I was so terrified. What if I can't finish it? How will I know what to do? You know, I had all these early writer phobias of just, I won't be able to finish it. It'll be awful and no one will read it. And, you know, I was just like, I was just a bundle of nerves, really. And then I would drag myself to the writing and go, oh, look, the writing really went great. And that was really fun. And I enjoyed being in that world with those people. And then it just like, you know, for a while I would write out of inspiration and I had a few funny things happen. First of all, I was so afraid that I wouldn't be able to finish the book that I decided to write the entire first draft longhand in pen. And so I wrote in journals. Yeah. And I filled 5 journals longhand in pen. And so then I had to turn around and transfer all of that into the typewriter. I mean, we're going back almost like to the way they did it with Tom Wolfe in the 1920s and 30s, right? You know, back in the day.
Yes.
But then I put it back into the computer, and as I was doing that, I was in a cafe, and I got up to go get my latte, and somebody stole my journal. So I lost an entire 300 pages of what I had written and called my mother hysterical, sobbing, and she said, oh, don't worry, the last time you were down here, I took all of your journals and copied all of them.
We love you, Mom.
Yes, saved by Mom. How many times have you like saved by Mom? Yeah. So Mom mailed me the copy of the lost journal. So yeah, and then I was able to sort of take it from there. But you know, it evolved. The whole process evolved. At the beginning, I was on shaky legs, and then toward the end, I started to realize this is the thing that I love most about life. And then if I had a moment, I was trying to get to squeeze in to write, whereas before I think I was more afraid, and then I came to really, you know, revel in loving it. And it was a lot of drafts and a lot of versions of the book before it finally got published. And that's a long story in and of itself.
And that is one of the things I was going to touch on briefly. Once it was completed and, you know, you were at that point, what's next? It's written. How did you decide? Because there's so many choices for an author now. You know, there is the traditional publishing, you know, big house or middle size or small publisher, or there's the self-published. How did you choose which route was best for you and your work? How did
you approach
that?
Well, I've done them all, so... yeah, I'm familiar. Okay. I'm familiar with them all, you know, and it's been more of like just getting thrown into the deep end. Like, here you go, learn how to swim. So I finished the novel first in an early round after about five, six years, and I sent it out to tons of agents, got a million rejections, and then a friend said, "Oh, I think I know of a literary agent who represents historical novelists who would love you." The book at the time was 900 pages long. And I talked to the agent on the phone, and he said, interesting, I'll take a look at it. Just send me the first 30 pages. And I was so terrified that he wouldn't summon the full 900 pages once he found out that I decided to mail him the entire bowling ball of the book. So I did. And he was just up there enough in years to think, oh, this book has arrived. Oh, I must have been so interested in it that I summoned the entire thing. So he read the entire thing. He edited the entire thing. And I thought, this is it. I'm, you know, my life is going to change. I'm going to get it out there. And this is before ebooks. This is before, you know, like e-publishing and self-publishing had really taken off. And he sent the book out to every single publishing house on three continents. And we got over 100 written rejections from editors.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And It was very agonizing and very hard, and mostly it was because the book crosses genre. It's romance, it's adventure, it's pure historical fiction with a little dash of fantasy because of the legend of the Emerald Tablet of Alexander the Great that I chose to play into the story with a group of kind of almost Egyptian Jedi that were known in the days of Alexander the Great to be guarding a tablet. So that just through everybody.
That is cool.
They were like, we don't know what the F to do with this book. I don't know if I can swear on your show. So, like, and they were like, it's great. We love it. We have no idea how to market it. And that turns out to be a really big problem because all the people who buy books are crunching numbers and they're saying, how can we expect to market this? And your book really has to cleanly fit in a genre. And it didn't. So ultimately that agent, Jacques de Spoolbert, bless him, he dropped me. He said, I can't sell this book for you. Two years later, I went another 3 years before I hooked up with another literary agent. And around that time, my book got optioned for film by an Academy Award-winning producer of Crash, Mark Harris. Who I met in a church parking lot and randomly accidentally discovered the best way to pitch a producer on your project, which is you'll hate it. This is not for you. You'll hate it. You'll hate it. And he said, oh, I've got to see it. I've got to see it. So he ended up loving it and shopping it around. And since he fell in love with it and was shopping it around, I decided to self-publish the book and retain the rights because I said, well, if he can sell it to Hollywood, and we can get a mini series out of it, something like a la Outlander, because my book gets compared to Outlander quite a lot, especially because of the sort of cross-genre heavy romance thing, plus heavy historical fiction, historical research aspects to it, because Diana Gabaldon is a great historical researcher as well. So I self-published, and it was great. I had books in hand. I could always send out books to producers and movie studios and people who are looking into the book. Mark is still connected to the book. And then I think at one point then, you know, another 4 years go by. Now we're going through like decades of my life on one book. And I'm going, how the F could this be happening to me? Because I thought this was, you know, I'm Irish, right? My ancestry is Irish. So, of course, I thought the direct path will take four years. And it's like, oh, no, Lassie, you've got to go all the way around past this steeple in the chapel and through this field of sheep. And then, you know, and there's a lovely place to have a picnic where you can stop and gaze at the stars. And then 10 years of your life will go by. And who knew? And you'll finally get to wherever you're going. So, yeah, I don't recommend doing anything I did, which is mostly happenstance. But the way HarperCollins came to the book, which was kind of cool because it was always my dream. I feel like Dorothy and Oz, you know. I'm like, one day Toto will get home. HarperCollins, you know, how do I get there? How do I get through all of it? Get rid of all these witches. So finally, I was like at a writer's conference. And, you know, you have to be bold as a writer or an artist or anyone. I think a lot of us struggle to promote our work. Like, we just feel like, but I should be able to do the work and then walk away. And I don't want to promote myself. It feels so uncomfortable. We're awkward with it. But there do come moments where you've got to have your work in hand, and you have to be willing to believe in it and yourself enough to press it into the hands of people who matter. And I had a moment like that at a writer's conference where I was speaking. And I met the head of Harper One, Claudia Buteau, who's the senior vice president. And I was with her for a moment, and I said, do you like stories about powerful women and women who are leaders? And she was like, yes. And I said, I have a book for you. And I just handed her my hardback. And she said, great, I love it. I said, do you know who Hypatia was? She was running the Great Library of Alexandria, Egypt. I think you would relate to her. She's a powerful woman just like you. She said, thank you. She left. She had my book. She had my business card. And 2 days later, I got an email from Claudia that said, I could not put this book down. I have been reading it for 2 days. It is one of the best books I have ever read in my life. And I am determined to place it within HarperCollins. Now, Claudia, being as powerful she was, I thought, I've made it. Oh, my God, this is great. I'd just given birth to my son. I needed money so badly. I can't even tell you. I was, like, single mom. You know, I've got to, like, got to get my break, as they call it in Hollywood. They call it making your bones as a writer. When you make your bones, you've got something to stand on. And I thought, oh, this will be it. You know, I'll make my bones. Well, it took her 4 years to get HarperCollins to say yes. All the editors said no. They all said, no, it's not right for us. It's this cross-genre fantasy, historical fiction, romance thing. We don't know how to sell it. It's sort of an Indiana Jones thing. Could they make it into a movie first before we turn it into a book? Yada, yada, yada. All the imprints declined. And finally, a brand new imprint was looking for visionary writers. And they are based in San Francisco with Harper One, which is all about these spiritual personal development authors, and they were looking for visionary fiction a la The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho, you know, books that like The Celestine Prophecy, where there's been books that have had spiritual meaning for people in their lives, and they were looking for books like that. And Claudia walked my book over to the office of the woman who is running that imprint, the editor, Anna, and said, I think you should read this. And the next thing I know, I got a call from Anna that said, we want to publish your book. So that was 15 years of, I mean, it's a mouthful. I hope I haven't overwhelmed anyone with this crazy story, but it really is that crazy.
That is incredible. I am determined now to read your book. I mean, after all of that, and I mean, seriously, I'm just, that's astounding. I've got to see what all of this was about. It sounds great. The story sounds great, and so definitely reading the book. So what was one thing that you've learned through the process of writing, getting it published? What was something that you learned that you did not realize starting out?
Well, I think I learned it would be not as easy as I thought. I thought it wouldn't be so hard. And so consequently, what's happened is it's really built my character. And I think more importantly than that, it's made me love writing and crafting a sentence more than my ego loves the idea of the book getting out there and being a big deal of some kind. And I think I had a lot of ego investment, like, oh, I want to have lots of readers, and I want to have this big book deal, and I want to have this big career. We have our dreams, and our dreams are important.
We do.
But it was realizing for me, oh, this craft is what saves me every day. When I said it's my third lung, I mean it. It saves me. I wake up, I'm able to do this, you know, at least a little bit every day. And when I sit down to write, I walk away feeling like I've breathed for my soul, and that my soul feels better because I've done this work. And you know, consequently, my brain also can't go creating and crafting fiction out of my life, which I've noticed it sometimes does like to do when I'm not writing. So it's healthy for me. And then I've fallen in love with that. And I didn't expect that as much, to really lean on this like a crutch, or, you know, like an externalized internal organ that I need. I didn't know I needed it. I thought I wanted it or liked it. Now I realize I need it.
That's incredible. Are you working on a sequel, or what's next? What is your next project?
Well, I have that little giggle. That little giggle says I've written another unpublishable book. I seem to really do well at these. I've written this incredibly salacious young adult novel. That's the book I wish was written when I was 16. That's LGBT, yes, and very sexual and very full of like all of the confusion and curiosity that I had when I was that age. And it's set in London. So that is hopefully my next book. It's finished and it's out with one of my agents now. I don't know if he'll represent it or not yet, because I don't know if the genre has changed enough, because I'm like the Antichrist John Green. So if the genre has changed enough that they're willing to tell the truth, because right now the genre is very, very Cinderella, like, you know, oh my gosh, the book ends with like, oh my gosh, he kissed me, wow, the end. And there's a lot of that. And I'm just like, I don't know who the F you were when you were 16, but dude, that was not me. You know, I was like into a lot of boys and girls and trouble and drugs and finding out who I was and spirituality and meditation and yoga and getting drunk. And I mean, it was just, I was just a mess. I was a mess, but I was a sweet hot mess. I hope, you know, looking back, and I wanted to write a book for those girls who are like, you know, lugging books around, who are smart and who are too smart for their age group, and who have these passions and desires, and who are reading these young adult books and going, I don't see me in there. These books aren't honest enough. Tell me the truth. Tell me the truth about love. Tell me the truth about sex. Tell me the truth about drugs. So that's the book that I wrote most recently, and right now it's called Indigo Dragonfly. And the next book will probably be a memoir, because I've had such a crazy life, and some part of me wants to write about my crazy life, like you said, swimming with dolphins and working in a touring magic show for a number of years, and dealing with a lot of insanity within my family and things I think people can relate to. So
that's incredible. You are wonderful. I love talking to you. I cannot even express it. It's just incredible. So your family, we know mom supports you. You know, she saved the book. Is that across the board? Are those in your life? Are they supportive of your career as a writer?
My mother and my stepfather have been amazing, especially my mother, although I'm really too afraid to share with her my very sexy young adult novel. We haven't gotten there yet. But there's something weird about shit talking and sharing sex with your mom. I don't know. I don't know if I'll bridge that gap.
Yes.
But she's been amazing. She believes in me. She loves me. She's been incredible. And I had a very narcissistic and difficult and controlling and temperamental father, that would be putting it lightly, who, when I first brought him my novels with so much pride of, you know, my youth and a little girl's heart that wants daddy to love her, I brought it to him to look at, and he just said, oh, I don't really read fiction, and put it on the bedside table. And the next morning I actually found it in the garbage.
Oh gosh, I'm so sorry.
So, goodness. Yeah, so that, you know, those two sides, but so many of us do have those two sides with parents who don't get us. And I was so blessed that I had at least one parent who got me, who said, this is what you need to do, and I'm behind you, and I support it. And I think in his own way, my father was behind me doing something that I loved, but he didn't get it, and he didn't care whether I got the love or the support or the kudos out of, you know, his approval, I guess is the right word, because it was never going to happen. So it had to be something I was going to do for me, because he was never going to be on the sidelines cheering me on.
Well, I'm so glad that you had the strength, the inner strength, to keep on and to push through all of those obstacles. That is phenomenal within itself. And I think that it's great. Within the book, Written in the Ashes, what is one of your favorite scenes and why?
Well, gosh, that's such a hard question to answer. There's so many scenes that I really love in this book. Of course, I love all the sex scenes, I have to be honest. I'm really proud. It's hard to write.
Okay, I'm definitely reading it now. You just got my attention. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, we were on the same page. It's hard to write about sex in a way that's, like, you know, really emotionally impactful. So that was what I was after, because there's a love triangle in the story. But that said, I was working within the bones of history, and the bones of history that were given to me were the burning of the Great Library, the exile of a quarter city's population, which was all of the Jews, overnight by the Christians, because there was a feud going on between the Christians and the Jews in the city. And the bishop was not a very nice guy. And he was really on an aggrandizing path to personal power within the city's Senate, because at the time church and state were mixed within the Roman Empire. So as Christianity grew in power, they also grew in power within the government, these bishops did. And this guy really wanted all of that for himself. So working in the history to the book to make it personal for my characters, my main character, Hannah, you know, as I mentioned, she was a shepherdess who was trafficked into slavery into Alexandria. So these were personal moments for her. The library burns, but okay, who cares? Well, she cares because her friends are in it as it's burning. You know, when the Jews are exiled, you know, overnight into the desert. Well, why does she care? Well, she's Jewish and she's going to go out there, roll up her sleeves and pretend to be a boy, so that she can try to carry some of the children of the Jewish families to safety, recognizing that these families may not survive going out into the desert with their small young children and babies. So they together work together. She and Alizar work together on the ship that he has to try to save some of the children of these families, which is, you know, this is a story that could be ripped from modern day headlines of right now. We have refugees, we have religious extremism, we have the dangerous tendency to confuse opinion and religiosity with fact, and the tendency to want to censor the world's knowledge based on our belief systems. Well, that was happening way back then, and it's an old game that we're seeing play out even in today's American presidential election. What are we going to put in power? And those questions were being asked then. So I think that modern readers, even though it's a story that goes back to 1600 years ago, will find themselves looking into a mirror of today in so many ways. And also true because, as of today, there are 6 million women missing on the planet. I don't know if you know this, because they've been trafficked or sold into slavery, trafficked. They are missing. 6 million. So while I've written a story about a young girl trafficked into slavery, that is also not an ancient problem. That is a very modern problem that is still with us today in a very real way, especially within the developing world. And I did want to use this character's plight to bring awareness to the plight of so many women and children who are vulnerable to this in our world today.
Well, that is incredible. No, I did not know that 6 million women. I don't even know what to say. That is incredible. I mean, I've heard about it. I knew, you know, I've heard in more of the underdeveloped countries and things like that. But I thought it was, you know, taken care of or done. I didn't realize that it was still as prevalent, because, you know, I heard about it as I was growing up in my teens. I didn't realize that it was still, you know, as prevalent.
Yes, well, you can sell drugs. you can, well, so am I, but you can sell drugs only one time, right? But you can sell a woman over and over.
Oh, my God.
So it's very common in Malaysia and India and some of these other countries where they realize that they can steal these young girls or trick them because they get them addicted to a drug like methamphetamines. And then they're in the brothel and they're getting methamphetamines and they won't leave the brothel because they're hooked on drugs. So you can read the work of Nicholas Kristof. He's a New York Times editorial columnist and really phenomenal book called Half the Sky, that where he talks a lot about this problem. But it's definitely out there. And as women, I mean, I feel as my own female heart wants to connect to other women and what they're going through my writing. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to find our power. We want to be able to use our voices. And I wrote this book about a girl who's a singer and her voice literally saved her life. So it's about learning how to use our voices, speak up, speak out for what we believe in, and, you know, be the kinds of leaders that we want our sons to admire and our daughters to emulate.
Love it. I love it. Thank you for that. And, well, we are getting down to time, but before we go, I did want to ask, what do you do just in your spare time? you're not writing and you just have a little time to yourself. What do you enjoy doing? Your hobbies?
Thank you so much. I'm learning how to surf right now, so I'm enjoying being a beginner. But I always get out there and flail on the board and I laugh my ass off and I love it. So it's great. It's really therapeutic because it gets me out of my brain. I do yoga and I also run. Being physical for me is really important because it keeps me healthy and it keeps my mind clear. And then I just spend time with my son who's about to turn 5 and I really enjoy my life with him and helping him get ready for Halloween and the things that he loves in his life. And our connection is really special to me as well.
Very cool. Awesome. So what would you say to a beginning writer, someone just starting out, what type of advice would you give them?
That's going to come from Winston Churchill, and it's 7 nevers. Never, 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 never give up.
Wow.
That's it, you know.
I love that.
If it's your dream, if it's important to you, make sure that it's important to you for life, no matter how hard life makes it for you to come through with it, because we need to hear your voice. The world needs your voice. And there will be so many times when you are terrified that your voice doesn't matter and no one cares and no one is interested in hearing what you have to say. And you will have to be your own champion and believe in yourself enough to say, my voice matters and the world needs it and I'm here to bring it. If you feel called to write and share your voice, you have to have that faith renewed daily that the world is wanting to hear it and that there will be an audience for you who will relate and connect to what you have to share.
Oh, my gosh. You were talking to me. I love that. I literally had tears well up. Go ahead.
Well, the only other option is despair. I mean, true. I've been there. So those are the only choices we have. It's faith or despair.
Yeah.
Or you wake up in the morning and go, no one cares. I don't matter. I don't know if this makes a difference. You know, and then you can spiral into a place of real misery. But the thing to realize is that our minds will take us there. So you either flex that muscle of faith or despair will take you down. And I've had to really learn how to do that and to help my other friends who write as well and just say, no, you've got to flex that muscle of faith and believe that you were put in this world by a mysterious force, whether you want to call it God or Great Spirit or whatever else you want to call it. And if you feel called to share your voice, there's a greater purpose moving through you and you got to trust it.
I love that. Love it. Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much, Kaya, for joining me this evening. I really have gained a lot from just having you, just chatting with you myself personally. So I know that the audience has as well. So thank you.
Oh, well, I love your spirit. Thank you so much for having me and talking about my book, Written in the Ashes. It's a joy to share it with everyone.
Yes, yes. Well, we're looking forward to, I'm going to read it, but also I'm looking forward to your next one. I'm sure it's going to get picked up and taken out there. and so it will. And where can everyone touch base with you and also buy copies of Written in the Ashes?
Yeah, well, the imprint Harper Legend that released my book only released it on Kindle. So you can get it for $2.99 on Amazon. Super easy, Written in the Ashes. And it's the cover with a goddess on it, which is really cool, actually. I drew that cover, and they used my art on the cover, which I don't think ever happens to a writer. So that was pretty amazing that they did that. And then to keep in touch with me, my literary name is K.HollandVanZant, but my name, as you've said, is Kaia, which is K-A-I-A. So they can find me at Kaia Van Zant everywhere. KaiaVanZant.com, Kaia Van Zant on Twitter, Kaia Van Zant on Instagram, and then all of those connect back. I do a lot of videos on YouTube. I like to talk to people via video, so they can find my videos on my website or on YouTube as well.
Perfect, perfect, perfect. Well, congratulations again on your newest release.
And thank you for this conversation. It's been a meaningful conversation. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Oh, I appreciate it. I'm just saying personally, as a writer and a woman, I appreciate it because I've gained so much from it. So thank you for being here. I really do believe that at times people, are placed when they are placed for a reason. And I'm so happy that you came this evening. So thank you again. You're more than welcome anytime. We would love, hopefully you can come back, chat also with my co-host, and you're welcome anytime.
All right.
So thank you so much.
I love it. Oh, thank
All right.
you. And have a great evening.
You too. And everyone that's listening, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Please go show some love for K. Holland Van Zant. Go pick up copies of Written in the Ashes. And also a big thank you to Teddy Rose over there at Premier Virtual Author Book Tours for connecting Indie Review behind the scenes with this wonderful, wonderful author. All right, guys, that is it. You have a wonderful weekend. I said wonderful a lot, but I mean it. Why? Because you deserve it. Have a good one, guys. Bye-bye.
Oh, yeah.